Vayam cha tatra bhagavan sarpajat yuromanyavaha yatam tyajamas tvam mayam dushtajam mohita svayam Vayam cha tatra bhagavan sarpajat yuromanyavaha tam tyajamas ton mayam dushchajam mohita svayam Vayam cha tatra bhagavan sarpajat yuromanyavaha katam tyajamas tvam mayam duschajam mohita svayam vayam we cha and tatra within that material creation bhagavan Oh, Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sarpaha, serpents. Jati, by species. Uru manyavaha, too much absorbed in anger. Katam, how? Jajamaha, we can give up. Tvat mayam, your illusory potency. Dushchajam, which is impossible to give up. Mohitaha, bewildered. Svayam, on our own. Translation. O Supreme Personality of Godhead, among all the species, within your material creation, we serpents are by nature always enraged, being thus illusioned by your illusory energy, which is very difficult to give up. How can we possibly give it up on our own? Purport. Kaliya is here indirectly begging for the Lord's mercy, realizing that on his own he can never become free from illusion and suffering. Only by surrendering to the Lord and obtaining his mercy can one be released from the painful conditions of material life. And text 59, translation. O Lord, since you are the omniscient Lord of the universe, you are the actual cause of freedom from illusion. Please arrange for us whatever you consider proper, whether it be mercy or punishment. And two verses commentary. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, paraphrasing Kaliya, I am very angry by nature, jati, by birth. Therefore, how is it possible for me to give up insurmountable maya on my own? Unquote. And Jiva Goswami, Oh, Supreme Lord Bhagavan, the idea that one becomes, this is interesting, that one becomes a snake by karma alone is rejected. Since the Lord is the controller of karma, therefore, I have not committed this offense on my own. He's passing the buck. Then how can it be given up? Except for your intervention. He's not passing the buck. He's saying, I'm not independent. Text 59, Vishwanath writes, You are the cause of giving up Maya. Tatra. Therefore, as you wish, you may be merciful or not merciful to me. Jiva Goswami. Since I cannot give up this nature on my own, you should do something. By you alone, this evil nature of mine can be given up. Do as you wish. Manya say, you know the power of your Maya and my miserable position. You should give mercy because you are the supreme independent Jagadishwara, and thus you can also punish me. Then he quotes a verse from Vishnu Purana, Yataham bhavata shrishto jatya rupena cheshvara swabhavena cha sadhudvam tatedam cheshtatam maya. Translation is, since I have been created in this species with a form by you, I act correctly by my nature. Now, I don't know if this is Vishnu Purana commenting on the same pastime or not, but it's appropriate in any case. You know the cause of mercy and punishment. Do one of these, since you are the Lord of the world, Jagadishwara, and because you are the Lord, even in punishing, you can give mercy. These two verses, they're on the same theme, and they're expanding the message from the first. And the first verse has this term, swabhava. So, swabhava, there's the material and spiritual. Swabhava, so swabhava in this case is the material one. Brahma karma swabhavajam, kshatriya karma swabhavajam, vaishya karma swabhavajam, shudra karma swabhavajam, swabhava, one's own nature. Each of us has a particular nature, psychophysical nature, according to the body and the mind. So bodies, just like we read yesterday, when you get the body of a dog, you bark, wag your tail and chew on bones and do dog things. When you get the body of a demigod or a king or whatever, or a serpent, you do according to the body. Now, how did one get the body? Well, guna and karma. Now, appropriately, in a very interesting way, actually, Jiva Goswami is saying, I can't do karma on my own, and I can't receive the results of karma on my own. You have a role to play. There are five factors of action. And one of them is Ishvara. So I'm not a dependent to do karma and get the serpent body. I was dependent upon you, and now to get free from this serpent body and its psychophysical nature, it's swabhava, I'm depending upon you because I can't do this on my own. So a little bit like, not the same, but a little bit like Harisham's question yesterday. Are we really supposed to go beyond our psychophysical nature or just engage according to our psychophysical nature and make it like really nice? It's a different way of stating the question that you asked yesterday. And, well, we get a clue, the answer to that question, from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's response to Ramananda Roy where the Varnashram system says you do what is your nature, your Varna and Ashram dedicated to Vishnu, and that brings one to the stage of perfection. But in that stage of perfection, same question. Are we within the boundaries of our body only psychophysical nature and just perfect it, offer that to Krishna? Or if Krishna so desires to take the serpent-like Kaliya out of that conditioning of his embodiment and beyond the disposition of having that body. That's, you know, in today's verse, this sarpa, uru. Uru means anger. Uru manyava, too much absorbed in anger. Too much absorbed in anger. Uru manyava. Can one go beyond one's swabhava or not? And then in that beyond one's physical and mental swabhava, engage in activities that are beyond that's limitation, swabhava. Well, of course. Simply, Krishna could do whatever he wants. And that's what Kali is asking for. And it's a fact that that's a core teaching of Bhagavad Gita. Now, when Lord Chaitanya heard that Vishnu Purana verse, his statement was, it's external. And what does that mean, it's external? Sounds pretty nice. It's in and of itself insufficient. It satisfies Vishnu, yes. In and of itself, it's not sufficient because the consciousness may not be sufficiently for the pleasure of Vishnu, I'm prepared to do anything for the pleasure of Vishnu. I'm prepared to do anything. This is beyond the Varnashram system. Can help one get beyond the Varnashram system. The thorn that helps remove the thorn. It's not in and of itself essential. Similar to the discussion last night, but we accept things insofar as they help us get to the destination for the purpose of reaching the destination. What's the destination? Pleasing Krishna. So why is it external? Why is it not sufficient? Because the consciousness may not be matured and therefore not sufficient or external. It's just looking at the behavior without necessarily looking at the consciousness behind the behavior sufficiently. Nothing wrong, but not sufficient. Go further. And interestingly, the verse that Ramananda Roy suggests that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepts is Brahma's prayer, Stane Stituk. Stane Stituk. Stay in your position. You don't have to give up your activity, karma sannyas, or you don't have to engage in Varnashram. Singularly. But stay in your position, so that means you have a psychophysical nature, engage according to your psychophysical nature. Anasaktasya vishayan yatarham upayunjitaha. Nirbandha Krishna sambande yuktam vaira. So this is Rupa Goswami's statement of what Lord Chaitanya's teaching is, which is represented in this Bhagavatam verse by Lord Brahma. But the essence is the hearing and chanting process. And through the hearing and chanting process, then we engage according to our psychophysical nature. That's the locomotive that's pulling the train. It's that which takes care of the anarcha-nivritti process sufficiently because of the emphasis on hearing and chanting, not just the behavior, but focused on the intent that Krishna should be pleased. That's bhakti. And that's the verse that Brahma is describing. So just a couple of other thoughts. Buddhism. Is it possible? The answer is no. Is it possible to get free from the Lord's Maya without calling upon the Lord to free one from his Maya by negation, by one's own effort alone? Is it possible? Answer, no. So then what is it? Well, it's definition by negation, or it's susupti. It's a state of deep sleep. It's equivalent to death. Now, when there's death, it's not that the soul goes out of existence, consciousness of the soul goes out of existence, desire goes out of existence. It's of the soul. It doesn't go out of existence in anesthetized state. But when you're anesthetized, you don't, desires are not awake. They're there. They're dormant until the anesthesia wears off. And then they awaken again. You know, awake, sleep, they're active through the mind. And deep sleep, they're suspended by the circumstance of the anesthesia. So my comment here is, and I think about this a lot because of visiting China, you know, it's an illusory state. It's another illusory state, as Prabhupada described, the last snare of Maya. It's not free from Maya. Both the impersonal and voidistic conception, the last snare of Maya, both. And the impersonal conception of Shankara is simply a word-juggly restatement of Buddha's teaching. There's some detail that I don't need to go into because it's very technical. But the formula of Shankara is just using different language as the formula of Buddha. Take Sanskrit terminology and just, you look at it and it's covered Buddhism. That's what our acharyas say, and one can detail it. But that's what it is. Now, is there such a thing as being one with the Lord, or is there such a thing as void? Because they're not identical. Void is not identical with become one. It's this sayujya mukti, or Brahman realization, exists. One can enter into the Brahman jyoti and twinkle. Individuality, personality, everything suspended, and you just exist, sat. You don't stop existing. And nirvana is you stop existing. In fact, you don't even exist. Presently you don't exist, but you think that you exist, and when you reach nirvana state, you realize that you don't exist. It's total nihilism. Is there such a thing? No. Prabhupada, there are two things in the creation of God. There is God, and that which comes from God, there's not a third thing. There's no void in the creation of God. So if you want to merge with or become one with the void or enter into the void. There's no such thing. It's la-la land. So consciousness may become suspended, like in anesthesia, but consciousness doesn't go out of existence. It's a fundamental and important conception. Is there consciousness or not? Like, what are we? Kayami. What are we? We are a conscious entity. That's a starting point. Different than matter. Not a conscious entity. The body is not a conscious. It appears to be conscious because of the presence of consciousness. And consciousness spreads through the body. But when the soul leaves, there's no consciousness within the body. And when anesthesia appears, there's no consciousness, but there's consciousness. It's just suspended in susupti state. It's really a sad aspiration. Vitaragavaya krodha. Angry krodha. That's Kaliya. But he's becoming a bhakta by the association of his good wives. But those that don't have such association, anger, Bhagavad Gita purport Prabhupada explains this position of impersonalism and voidism arises from frustration and anger. Too much, I can't take it. Then we become one with the Supreme. Let me just go out of existence. You know, even more than suicide. Just go out of existence. Nihilism. Born of frustration. Anger. But it's not possible we can't go out of existence. We're eternal sparks. And we can't overcome Maya on our own also. Even by becoming a Buddhist. Or an impersonalist, or a yogi that goes to the Himalayas and does what yogis that go to Himalayas do. Do meditation and solitude and don't cheat and actually try to become one with Brahman. And then come back down the mountain and start schools, hospitals, and do philanthropy. When one has rejected the material world as false. Jagat mithya. It's false. Literally, sorry to go into this in one sense, but it's word jugglery. The conundrum, the living entity doesn't exist. There's no such thing, this if you're an impersonalist, no such thing. No such thing as Paramatma. No such thing as Atma. All there is Brahman. So we're Brahman, and that's who we are. We're that which is the topmost thing that exists, Brahman. The only thing that exists. And anything else doesn't exist. So if nothing else exists, how did that which is the only thing that exists become covered by illusion? That means illusion is greater than Brahman. No. Illusion is false. It just doesn't exist. It's word jugglery. Well, how did it happen? Well, it didn't happen because just you think it happened. But it never happened. You just have to realize it never happened. It's like drinking Kool-Aid or something. It's word jugglery. Does Maya exist or not? No, it doesn't exist. And how does that which doesn't exist cover that which exists? Well, it doesn't cover that which exists, but you just have to overcome that which doesn't exist. So you realize you're Brahman. It's word jugglery. Paramatma doesn't exist. There's no such thing. No such thing as individual souls. No such thing as souls. Your experience of individual consciousness of your body, it just doesn't exist. Excuse me. Well, it only appears to exist, covered by Maya. Well, then Maya's covering Brahman. No, that's, it just doesn't exist. And highly intellectual people really like this one, born of frustration. And by word jugglery, that there's this, sorry, Jeff. In the commentary of Tattva Sandarbha by Gopi Pranadana Prabhu, he has detailed the history of the interpretation of the Mayavadis. And some Mayavadis, like really, you know, big ones, followers of Shankara, wrote volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes of this means that, just to get to the position of I'm Brahman. It's so entangling, so mind-bending, so, like, what's he talking about kind of thing. Most people just stay away or just say, gosh, it's got to be true because this guy, and I can't understand what he's saying. It's something, you know, maybe you've heard the lecture where Prabhupada is speaking, what scientists say, some scientists, not this one over here. But bombastic words, Prabhupada, you know, for about 15 seconds starts using word jugglery kind of language and bibbidi bobbidi boobidi boobidi boobaboo. What does that mean? Well, I can't understand it. It must be this man's really intelligent. Now, some people that like that territory, they get involved in that language and this means that. And then they come up with another, no, this doesn't mean that, it means something else. You know, tarka apratishta. And so this is going on in the world of science and in the world of philosophy, impersonal philosophy in particular. The short of it is, we can't get free from the influence of Maya on our own effort. Kali understands that. And so he's appealing to Krishna to remove the covering of Maya. You know, Devahuti did the same thing. She wasn't a serpent, but she understood, I'm an illusion, and it's your illusion, it's your illusory potency. You permitted it to cover me. Can you please remove it? Thank you very much. Because on our own, we can't. And it's nice that we can't. Because we have this dependent, loving relationship of serving Krishna. We have to take not just petition for something material or please remove the illusion. The medium of that happening is through the medium of service. Through the medium of service. Krishna sees, okay, this living entity really wants to be again situated in his eternal loving service, or her eternal loving service. So Krishna can pull back the curtain, or Krishna can remove the same language that Kunti uses, is Atma Maya or Yoga Maya. He can cover and he can uncover. So, a concluding remark is, you know, you can do with me whatever you like, which means you can reward or you can punish, because even in punishment, there's reward. There's your connection. So he's already punished in one sense. The hoods of Kali, his body is smashed, his hoods. Smashed and mangled. Some very interesting illustrations, just like Because on the one hand, his dancing was very elegant. Nataraj, the king of dance. And on the other hand, he was as heavy as the universe, like Prahlad, standing on one foot of the whole universe. The whole earth planet was going down because the weight of the universe was pressing on the earth. The weight of the universe, the weight of the totality of every weighty thing was on the hoods of Kali. Krishna was arranging that. Smash, smash, smash. So Hari got mercy by getting smashed. And his enviousness has already largely been removed because here, listen to these prayers he's offering. But he's not saying, hey, thank a lot, you relieved my envy. He's in this humble mood, which is appropriate for one who's trying to serve Krishna, appealing for that mercy. Very nice segment. Very instructive for us also. You know, sometimes we have difficulties. Sometimes there's ordeals, and sometimes Prabhupada's language is reversal. Sometimes you're going this way and everything seems just according to plan, and next thing you know, you're going that way. Like what happened? We all know what that is. It's not fun when it happens. It's like... But bhakti accepts that's also mercy. So do with me what you like and mean it. Kind of like, you know, my dear Lord Krishna, my heart is filled with impure things. By your mercy, please remove those impure things. And Krishna starts to remove the impure things, we start complaining. Not that one. That's my favorite one. I'm really attached to it. Hari, this from the previous verse, he shows his special mercy by taking away the affinity for asat, or our material psychophysical nature, attachment to that. We engage our body and our mind and our powers of senses, speech and locomotion and everything else. If Krishna takes it away, Krishna takes it away. If Krishna gives it, Krishna gives it. And when we have it, we use it. And if he takes it away, we use what we have, what's left, till the time of death. Everything is taken away. Then what? What's the false shelter that's left anymore? So we have the opportunity to practice. Genuine shelter, that's what he's appealing for. Very practical in our lives also, because it may be incremental instead of like drastic or abrupt. Any discussion? Yeah.
Guru Maharaj,
go ahead.
I had a comment and a question.
Okay.
Comment was just appreciating your last comment about how it's it can be gradual or abrupt. In Kalia's case, how he moved from being this angry, envious, proud person to humble, recognizing he has a problem of enviousness and anger, and then also recognizing very quickly that he can be the one to control or to remove it, that he's dependent on Krishna. In comparison, Jarasandha was smashed, but he didn't. He was smashed again and then smashed again, but yet he did not learn his lesson. So the progress that Kalia made in a very short amount of time is quite impressive. That was one comment. And the question I had, is it significant that in his prayers, he doesn't, unlike Brahma who says, Tatenu Kampam Susumikshmana, whatever you wish to give me, and then he specifically requests, may I be in your service. Is it significant that in his prayers there isn't explicit expression of, I wish to be in your service?
We didn't finish the prayers. I didn't read to the chapter.
I think that's it.
Huh?
This is it. The next verse is where Krishna responds.
Wrap up. Okay. Interesting. It sounds like more of a comment than a question. He didn't say it explicitly. It's a comment. Now why he didn't say it explicitly? Maybe he did and it's just not there. It should be the Swami's present rendering. It's not, say it differently, it's not possible. Well, anything's possible for Krishna, but it's not standard that Krishna remove all of that without the intention, the pure conscious intention of being engaged in Krishna's service. So it seems implicit rather than explicit. Mother Bungal.
Maharaj, I was thinking about the situation towards the end of the class. You mentioned about Kalia, how in case of Kalia, the Supreme Lord himself is stepping and dancing, and while doing the pastime, he was also removing the anarthas of Kalia, his anger and the envy. As a practicing devotee, when some things happen, there is this tendency that comes out to think that I'm not such a devotee that Krishna directly... I'm not such a exalted devotee that Krishna would directly intervene in my situation.
That's true.
To bring the purification.
Not exalted devotee. But it's not that because we're not a very exalted devotee, Krishna would help us. That's the wrong conclusion. The nature of a person who is kind is they're kind.
The question is more towards the instrument of the purification itself, to see that perhaps we get caught up in the moment of the illusory potency itself to blame the instrument or to complain that which is bringing the purification, rather than accepting, I just want my heart to be purified.
We want material happiness. And something interferes with our material happiness, and we whine and complain. It says we're conditioned souls. We forget Krishna, and it's, you know, to what you just described. Because we're conditioned souls, and you have a long-standing tendency like that. We want material happiness. Aisha.
Maharaj, when you were speaking, I was thinking about that story that Srila Prabhupada likes to recount of the king who was visited by a sage, and the king asked the sage, how do I become free of entanglement? And the sage said, come to the forest tomorrow. And when the king comes, he sees the sage is holding on to a tree, screaming, let go, let go. And the king says, you're the one holding on. The sage says, exactly, walks away. And I was thinking that in this context also, Krishna is ready to take away our material condition. Krishna is ready to take away our
conditioning,
if we are willing to let go. So I've been meditating recently on where does that impetus, that will, come into our system to actually want to let go. Because that's our part, right? Krishna will do the rest.
Your question is, how do we ramp up the desire to let go? That's your question? Well, hearing is primary, and often hearing requires hearing again and again and again and again and again. And then one can't. Hearing Prabhupada explain in Hyderabad, a lecture before an Indian audience, apparently gesturing to his or indicating his European-American disciples and explaining how they have accepted. And just hearing again and again and again and again. And again and again. So they now they have accepted. Specifically, we're not the body. But, you know, we cling to that conception because we don't have that conception. What's left? Who are we if we're not the body? I mean, it's part of our conditioning. So the desire to let go can come from hearing from a qualified person again and again and again and again because we're attached. So, but to let go, the strength of hearing and chanting. Then another one is learn the hard way, suffer. You know, we want to let go when we're suffering. And then when the suffering subsides, we hold on again. But so that's one of the impetuses, is suffering. Learning the hard way, the school of hard knocks, as they say. Association of those who are in the space of having let go or in the moving in the direction of letting go. That helps to let go, the willingness to let go. Just by that association, strength beyond our own strength, intelligence beyond. So, still, it doesn't take away the necessity that we make free will choice. And Krishna seeing the free will choice, Krishna reciprocates with the free will choice. That's what he does. He doesn't interfere. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Maharaj. I was reflecting on how all of those things you mentioned were crucial in my life also for entering the path of Krishna consciousness. But one thing I observed in myself and also sometimes in others is that when we're new, it's very...
When we're what?
When we are new...
When we're new...
To the process, to the life of bhakti, it's very easy to let go of our conditioning or our, say, our material desires.
Because we were suffering and we want to stop suffering.
Yeah, we want to stop. And then the classic scenario is that as you mature, you realize, well, I'm also a human being. You know,
you realize what?
That I'm also a human being. That yes, I'm a spirit soul, the eternal servant of Krishna, but I'm also a human being who has certain proclivities, tendencies. And oftentimes I see sometimes devotees, including myself, either will go into the extreme of, well, I have to also satisfy my conditioning, that itch is there. At the expense of my spiritual growth, it's almost like we live in these extremes, you know. So what is the healthy balance of, you know, how does one come to that healthy stage where it's like, okay, I'm a human, I have needs, but I'm also the eternal servant of Krishna, so both.
Yatarham, that's the healthy stage, according to suitability, which is kind of like, huh? What does that mean? So for each of us, there's a different suitability than the other person. And even within us, at sometimes this is more suitable and that's more suitable. So the suitability barometer is that which will help me remain steady. So I accept anasaktasya vishayan without the intention of satisfying material desire or satisfying the senses by accepting some object, yatarham upayunjata, towards the purpose of pleasing Krishna. So someone may, what's suitable for someone is this, and someone suitable is that. When I think of that verse, I think of Ambarish Prabhu. I mean, one of the things I think about is because he has the karma to handle all that wealth, he has taken birth in that family, and when he was young, he has, I don't know the detail, but you know, he was, you know, doing what wealthy people that have no direction do. He was, you know, in the world of sense gratification, experimenting like people of our time did, with varieties of sense gratification. And then he met Prabhupada. So he has the capacity to handle that wealth that some people don't have the capacity to handle that wealth. Krishna gave it to him. Now he has relatives that don't have Krishna bhakti, and they're doing whatever they're doing, trying to make the empire greater or living a life of lavish luxury. So he doesn't live a life of lavish luxury. He has a simple home. I mean, he has a home, but it's not a lavish home. It's really hot in North Florida. So when his mother died, he received her summer home in Maine or wherever it is. So he goes there in the summer and goes back in the winter. But he didn't live lavishly, and he uses it wisely. He's very, you know, prudent in how he distributes that which is in his hand. So according to suitability, he's been given that asset, that privilege. That some people, they, you know, like people that win the lottery, they go nuts. They spoil their lives. It's like statistically a fact, for, you know, out of many, many factors. They binge, they lose their friends because people just want money instead of friendship, and on and on and on. They go crazy with addiction and all kinds of things. So because they don't have the karma, they don't have the, it's not suitable for them to have that. But somehow they won the lottery, and their life becomes spoiled. Better they didn't have it. So your question was, you know, how do you get this position that's what you require? It's that which is sustainable. That's where your bhakti is sustainable. That's what you require. And always trying to leverage things, keeping things more simple, not artificially, except according to suitability. Then we have to introspect and have to have good guides. One of the new devotees came and spoke to me about how you had guided them in a certain area of their service, and after I heard the whole picture, he gave the right advice. You'll spoil your spiritual life if you keep going down that path. Yes, Charinishta.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. In today's world, Buddhism is very highly regarded.
Yes.
We have the Four Noble Truths, and my question is kind of, Did Buddha not himself pursue a particular authentic thing, but rather the followers kind of made a mess out of it? Or because we quote from Buddha, we may give Buddha...
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what he actually pursued or didn't. I don't know. We know what the Bhagavatam says. He gave a certain teaching for a certain time and circumstance. And the teaching was for the time and circumstance. People were misusing the Vedas, doing violence, and he stopped it. Reject the Vedas, stop violence. Now, what consciousness? you know, I don't know.
I was just reflecting how it seems that, well, I'll just conclude with one other question. When I see the way that Prabhupada preached against Mayavadism, the one question that comes to my mind in Prabhupada's preaching is why he didn't directly confront more of the... because he had such a fighting spirit.
He did.
Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, and in his books, in his speeches, but directly going and meeting these people and publicly, it didn't seem that that was a major aspect or a prominent regular aspect.
I want you to read Burijan's book. What's the title? My Beloved Master or something like that. My Glorious Master. An Encounter in Tokyo with a Mayavadi. Have you read it? Oh. Prabhupada would live it. It was a long, nice story. I won't tell the story. He would live it. And it wasn't for show. It was just intolerable for him to hear this man speak the way he was speaking. And he erupted, completely disturbed the whole proceeding, because he was the guest of honor and Prabhupada was like the second guy. So Prabhupada came first and sat in the primary guy's seat and wouldn't move. And the primary guy came and wanted to sit in the primary seat, and Prabhupada wouldn't move. And Prabhupada spoke first, because then when the man was speaking, Prabhupada interrupted him, and I don't remember exactly what happened, but he exploded. Now, time, place, circumstance, following the indication of Supersoul, why didn't he do it more often in some other way, like Shivaram Maharaj describes in his Vyasa Puja offering of how he dealt with the Mayavadi at some function in the Bhaktivedanta manner. You know, Prabhupada could have done that. But he had a different, you know, inspiration from Supersoul and just did the way he did what he did. It was intolerable for him. It was too painful for him. So he was training. But then there's another nice story. There's another nice story. You probably heard this one. Prabhupada was in Chennai, then Madras, and we didn't own the place. It was a rented place. And some scholar, Mayavadi, not a sannyasi, came to speak with him, Prabhupada, for more than 1 hour. He was criticizing Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita because he wasn't, you know, the literal doesn't say chant Hare Krishna, and you're saying chant Hare Krishna. What else? You know, and on for 1 hour. Specific verse. The man had studied Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita very carefully, and he was just criticizing it. And Prabhupada just kept him going, you know, what else? And then at the end of 1 hour, he didn't even respond to the man. He said, okay, it's now time for prasadam. Please give the man some prasadam. Please take this nectar devotion. You may find it nice. You may find it enjoyable. And off the man went. And the devotees were like, what? And Prabhupada said, he said Krishna's name so many times. Maybe next time when he comes, he'll inquire, because he became purified by saying Krishna's name so many times. Now, different times he would do different things. Sometimes he was explosive. But inspired by Supersoul, that's how I take it. And so he chose to educate us, or his followers, his students. And it's not that those people didn't read his books, but if, you know, someone was interested, he would engage with them. It's a little bit, another way of saying the same thing. I had enormous regard for Sataputta, and we had exchanges in different times, in different ways. And one time I was sharing with him what I had been doing in presenting his Mysteries of a Sacred Universe, blah, 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 and the response, etc. And I asked him, would you be interested in having somebody set up a tour for you, where you can... And he very politely, gently said, no thanks, because my experience is people haven't read what I've written, and they just want to throw things at me, and it doesn't go anywhere. It's like, you know, dealing with a born-again Christian, it doesn't go anywhere. You don't want to deal with those people. But if somebody has studied my books and they have some specific question, I'm very happy to meet with those people and engage in dialogue on specific points from my books. But I don't want to do that other one. Now, that's Sataputta, not necessarily Prabhupada, but that's not so dissimilar. If somebody wants to engage in wholesome dialogue, he would. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't want to hang out with the Mayavadis or blast them. Dealt with the devotees. Srila Prabhupada ki.